Welcome to the Agile Book Club. Here are your hosts, Justyna and Paul.
Hello, Justyna.
Hi, Paul.
So hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Agile Book Club. Today, we're going to be talking to Ryan Ripley, one of the two authors of Fixing Your Scrum, the book that we reviewed 2 weeks ago. Now, I want to tell you before we get started here, there's a tool that we always use for interviewing authors, and it's one of the reasons why the interviews sound as good as they do, because this tool records the audio on their side rather than sending it over the internet. So we don't get any of those sort of voice over IP internet flaws and issues. And this time we had some difficulty with that tool, and so we ended up just using Skype at the spur of the moment because Ryan was there and ready to go, and we were here in our studio and ready to go. And so there is going to be some echoes, there is going to be a little bit of background noise, and there's going to be the occasional little internet hiccup. But I'm going to edit this to make sure that it flows as smoothly as possible. And I can assure you it is absolutely worth your time because Ryan is a brilliant conversationalist, full of good ideas, and there's a lot of really good content here that he shared with us in this interview that you won't find in the book. So join us now as we talk about Fixing Your Scrum with Ryan Ripley. Thank you so much for joining us. Unfortunately, you haven't had a chance to hear the review that we're going to be talking about today because I've just finished editing it and it's going live at midnight Pacific time tonight. But the review of the book will be out tomorrow. Spoiler, we loved it.
Yes, very, very, very much.
Well, great. I'm glad that the review is going to be positive. So thank you for that.
So one of the things that I came into it with a bit of apprehension, and the cause of my apprehension is that I've seen so many I can write a book too books in some of the other disciplines that I follow. Now that in these days of self-publishing, suddenly everybody wants to say, well, this is me telling you how to do Scrum, and this is me telling you how to do Scrum, and they all just go over mostly the same material. And I was thinking, what is there new that we can say about Scrum after 20 years of practicing and publishing about it? And I was very pleased to see that you had a lot of new things to say about Scrum. The experience really comes through and speaks to Scrum Masters, suffering Scrum Masters everywhere, and we appreciate it.
Not only suffering Scrum Masters, yeah, mostly. Yeah.
No, so, that's very kind, so I really appreciate that.
So there were a couple of things that you really stressed more in your book than in just about any other book that I've seen. Among them are a common thread through the whole book is the essential role that embracing and developing and living by Scrum values plays in any successful Scrum implementation. Can you tell me a bit about what values mean to you as a Scrum Master and as a Scrum Coach? I think I would just like to hear you talk a bit about the role that values play in successful Scrum implementations.
Yeah, to me, the values are actually, they're everything. I think it's possible. What we've seen in the last 20 years and what Todd and I have seen collectively over the past, you know, our collective experience of over 40 years is mechanical Scrum or bad Scrum or dark Scrum or zombie Scrum, or, you know, Ron Jeffries calls it dark Scrum. The liberators in the Netherlands call it zombie Scrum. Todd and I just look at it as valueless Scrum, right? It's very possible to do these mechanical things and not get the value that you're expecting out of the Scrum framework, and to not be opportunistic in the marketplace, and not to bring joy to the workplace, and not to have, you know, work that people are proud of, and not to connect people to purpose. And we intentionally took a look at what was hurting teams, what was causing people to, you know, as you mentioned, to suffer as a Scrum Master. And we thought it's a Scrum practice that's lacking values. And that was really important to us to really highlight in the book, is that if you do not have focus, openness, courage, commitment, and respect just flowing through your behaviors and at play in your Scrum practice, you are going to suffer. It's going to be a long, difficult road for you. And I think, you know, when you think about focus, right? Focus means We can solve one problem at a time. We have the ability to look at work and actually think hard on it as a team together, come up with a solution for it and execute and deliver and then move on to the next thing and the next thing, knowing full well that we're focused on that work, but we're also focused on the why of that work and the purpose of the work and the customer we're serving and how we're changing the world and being able to keep that front of mind. When I think of openness, you know, open to new and interesting ideas, diversity of thought is so important on a Scrum team, but far too often we're not open to other people's ideas. And even for me, like, I think we talk about this a little bit in the book too, where I had to learn how to be open to the idea that I could be wrong. That was a really big development moment for me as a Scrum Master and even as just as a person that I, you know, because we all say things that we think are correct. I don't think anyone's out there, you know, saying things that are just intentionally false, or at least most people aren't doing that. And so when you say something, being open to that idea that, wow, what I just said, I believe it, but I'd better be open to new ideas and data that can change it. Commitment is weird in the Scrum world because there's still this old idea that the only part of commitment is just commitment to scope, and that's so false. We don't commit to scope. We commit to each other as teammates to bring our best selves forward, to lift each other up, to help one another when we're stuck. We're committed to honoring the investment the product owner is making in this product and making sure that every time we touch a keyboard that we're spending money in the right ways. And we're committed to the Scrum framework and we're committed to bringing value into the world. And, you know, we have the courage to speak up when things aren't going right, when transparency is difficult. That's when courage is needed the most. And we have the courage to say when we're stuck. We have the courage to ask for help and all those great things. And finally, respect. You know, the four other values, they just fall completely flat if we're not able to do these all of these activities in a respectful way. It's hard to tell your teammate that you think that something isn't right with their work. And so we have to leverage courage, but also make sure we're doing it in a respectful way that not only, and with our commitment to them as a teammate. So yeah, this work may not be right, but I'm going to partner with you. I'm going to pair with you. And it's because I care about you as a person and we're going to figure this out. And I think when we walk through those values, and when a lot of teams think about their current Scrum practice, they realize, wow, we have the mechanical pieces in place. They've still probably changed a few things, but for the most part, mechanically they're sound, but the behaviors are just missing. And when those behaviors are gone, your Scrum practice really suffers. And I'm really pleased that as you read and then reviewed the book, that message shone through. And I mean, that's just, you have no idea how happy that makes Todd and I.
Well, you know, obviously one can recruit for values, but when you're doing an initial implementation, when you're doing a transformation, you have to work with the existing values that the people that are on your team hold. How effective can a Scrum coach or a Scrum Master be in changing people's values and behavior?
You know, I have found that over the years, if I want to change other people, I have to change myself first. And so I think as a Scrum Master, I think every Scrum Master who hears this, who reads the book, who becomes interested in this kind of work, I think they can sit down and honestly evaluate, do they actually live and breathe and believe in these values? And do they want to become the personification of those values in the workplace? And if there is a gap, if they don't necessarily agree with some of them, how do they reconcile that? You know, we get maybe kind of a corollary question to this, you know, who's the right person to be a Scrum Master? Maybe that's like a first step. And through the creation of this book and years of talking about this, Todd and I really thought about what it would take. And we came up with three things. And you know, the first one is you have to love your team. And that word is so weird to use in a tech environment, in a product environment, but we mean it. It's that level of caring, of commitment, of investment in the people around you. You actually care more about their career progression than your own, like that kind of level of servant leadership. And the second thing is, now that you have that framing about these people, you want them to be wildly successful. Like, your purpose on this planet is to get your team to new heights of success, of delivery, of influence, not for yourself, but for others, which is really, really hard. And then finally, you have to have zero tolerance for the things that get in your team's way. If there's an organizational impediment that pops up, we've got to take care of it. If there's a relationship on the team that's suffering, we step in, we facilitate, we coach, we mentor, we lead. And if you find someone that can do those three things, I think Todd and myself and all the great Scrum coaches and Scrum Masters out there, we can teach the framework, but we cannot teach that mindset. I think, you know, back to the first part of that answer, it's if you're listening to this and you're a Scrum Master and you're not totally bought into that, I think it's time to have an introspective moment and really think about, you know, what do I believe and how do I serve? And do I realize that I'm there to serve? And I think that can help the most. And then once that Scrum Master or that Scrum coach's mind is right, and we kind of focus on, you know, I'll tell one of the dirty secrets of Scrum, right? The Scrum Master role is not about the Scrum Master. It's, in fact, when you take on that role, it's not about you at all. And that is so difficult for many. It was horribly difficult for me to wrap my head around. I came from a project management leadership background, and I was used to the spotlight. I was used to, you know, giving the big presentation. I was used to saving the day and all of that great stuff, that hero kind of culture. And when I switched, it took me probably a year of introspection and journaling and reading and thinking and getting mentoring from great people to get this whole focus on myself pushed to the side and really figure out that I'm there to serve others and none of this is about me. And once you get that straight in your head, then I think we're back to, Paul, the basis of your question, where now I can go out and I can live those values. I can serve others. And I think when people, it's infectious. When people see that, that's the kind of person they want to follow. And that's the kind of person people honestly want to be. And I think we spread that, those ideas, and it just kind of catches on. But I think first and foremost, Scrum Masters, we have to get our mindset kind of straight. We have to figure out who we are as a person. And once we get ourselves kind of, you know, just kind of inundated with all of the Scrum values and actually believe and live them, then some of the progress you're talking about, I think, is possible.
Fabulous. Well, I absolutely agree with you. And I really like the way, I don't want to use the word love twice in the same sentence. I really like the way that you use the expression that you have to love your team. And I can see why that would be misconstrued. But I think most of us who have been in long-term relationships have at some point in time hopefully come to the conclusion that love isn't a feeling. It's a verb. It's something you do every day. It's a set of actions and that reinforce the beliefs that drive those actions. And indeed, a Scrum Master can learn to love their team. And if they can't, then they're going to have a very difficult time having a positive impact on them.
Yeah, it's a long road. And that's just our observation. There's probably so many other models and things to think about. But our observation is without that initial just strong feeling towards that team and acting it out, as you mentioned, it's just such a long road for both the team and the Scrum Master.
Oh, Brian, I have a big difficulty actually to start talking right now because I'm enjoying so much listening to your answers, but I think it's a time that I ask a question.
And sure.
As Paul mentioned, we loved your book, but there was one thing that I was constantly wondering, like, what is the most dangerous Scrum misconception, in your opinion? You mentioned a lot of anti-patterns, a lot of problems, self-defined Scrums by different kind of organization. And I was just wondering, what is the most dangerous, in your opinion?
So, yeah, this is people are wondering, like, you know, what's the thing that we have to take care of? And so Todd and I actually, we have different views on this. And so for me, I mean, they're all dangerous. I think they all cause us to lose the ability to deliver. But for me, I think the sprint goal is just so misunderstood. And we really tried in the book to emphasize the fact that the sprint goal is not optional. I think far too many teams just try to load up their sprint backlog with as much work as possible. They don't care if it's a cohesive body of work. They don't care if there's a greater goal to the work. They're just trying to chop through their product backlogs as quickly as possible. And I think that leads to burnout. It leads to kind of a treadmill mentality for a team where they're just constantly working on things, but they're not sure why. It diminishes focus. It demotivates teams. If you really want to demotivate your development team, do not let them know why they're doing their work. Do not connect them to a customer. And then you'll have people who are just showing up to collect a check and to perhaps burn through a few features, but it's not this joyful kind of work that we're after. The sprint goal gives us that. You know, I think this sprint goal is seen as this optional, yeah, maybe we'll set a goal, maybe not. The sprint goal is mentioned 27 times in the current version of the Scrum Guide. It is clearly not optional. And when you think about what the sprint goal does, it's so important for a team. I think it gives us focus. It gives us the ability to say, look, this is the outcome we're after. This is how we are connecting to a customer. This is how we're impacting the life of a person using our product. It's outcome driven, right? And so we know how we're serving others, and anything that would distract us from that, we can say no to because that goal is present. But it also gives that inspirational kind of boost to the dev team. They can actually know how they're going to help someone. And that just changes the way we show up for work, right? People actually, if we really connect people to customers and we do that through a sprint goal, people show up excited to work. They show up knowing how they're helping others. It's just, it changes the behavior and the tone and the level of happiness on a team. But I think people don't understand often how to write a sprint goal, or at least a good one. And so in the book, we talk about some different rules. You know, we try to get people to avoid commas in their sprint goal. There should be no JIRA ticket numbers in your sprint goal. The word and is problematic. You know, we're trying to get people to focus on the idea that it's customer facing, right? The sprint goal is written in a way that you would know how it's outcome based, right? It's how it's the new thing you're enabling a customer to do. It's not JIRA ticket number 12837, comma 12845, comma. You know, that's a horrible sprint goal and it's not inspirational and no one cares about that. But if you say, you know, empower a customer to do something that they couldn't do before so that they can save the planet whatever it is that the outcome you're investing in, I mean, that people read that and they say, all right, now I know why I'm doing my work. I know how I'm serving a customer and I know what success looks like. And now we can creatively go about doing that by pulling work into the sprint backlog and executing together as a team. I think it's just such an amazing piece of the framework that so many teams unfortunately skip or diminish or turn into just a list of scope. That for me, that one is the really big one.
Although I think it's interesting that these ideas, these unhelpful ideas are so persistent, because unless I'm mistaken, the sprint goal has probably been the most dynamic part of the framework over the framework's lifespan. My initial introductions to Scrum almost 20 years ago had no component of a sprint goal. The sprint goal, I don't know when it was introduced into the Scrum Guide, but I don't believe that the sprint goal even appeared in the first Scrum book. So this is a reasonably new idea, just in the last several years.
Yeah, I would have to go back and check the Schwaber and Beadle book, but I think you're right, Paul. I think that originally sprint goal, but you know what? That's what I love about Scrum, where Ken Schwaber and Jeff Sutherland periodically get back together and they iterate on the Scrum Guide, they reflect on the Scrum Guide, and I think what I think is right. And awesome about what they've done is that they realize that the world's moving quickly. They realize that sometimes they need to sit down and perhaps refine the ideas that they originally came up with. I think that's the problem of being a genius. And I think Ken and Jeff are certainly in that category, that what's clear to them, what's obvious to them may not be obvious to mere mortals like myself. And I think it's great that they take feedback on the scrumguides.org site and they actually reflect on that. Maybe the sprint goal idea that is obvious to us wasn't to them. I don't know how exactly they came about it. But I think it's great that even the Scrum Guide evolves and changes over time. I mean, the Scrum values were brought back, I think, in 2007, right? So the Scrum values were not a part of the guide for a number of years. And I think it's great that those were brought back because we were seeing behavioral issues on Scrum teams. And now we're going to bring that to the forefront, and sprint goals were needed to focus and align Scrum teams. And I can't wait to see what they decide to do next, right? Whenever the next version, you know, if they decide to do an update, I can't wait to see what they want to amplify it and help teams with next.
Well, I think you definitely made a contribution because I was aware of the evolution of this concept from the initial way that it was understood 15, 20 years ago, which was a sprint commitment. A team would commit to a certain amount of work based on their historic velocity. And that obviously was problematic for a lot of people. I even remember the arguments at the time, 10, 15 years ago, when people would... The common response to if you're having trouble meeting your sprint commitments is that you haven't gotten good enough at estimating. And so as a community, we have learned a lot, and we've learned a lot from our mistakes. And I think you've made a fabulous contribution to that conversation with your very clear articulation of the role of the sprint goal. I want to talk to you about something else, though. This is another thing that really jumped out at me when I was reading your book. Actually, it terrified me when I was reading your book. And I talk about this rather at length in the review, but that is simultaneously the absolutely critical nature that the product owner plays. A product owner can make or break the product, obviously, as well as the team and all of the interactions. So that it's an absolutely critical role, but it is also an incredibly difficult role to fill. Could you talk a bit about the challenges of finding and developing the ideal product owner?
Yeah, absolutely. This role is just, it's massive. And when I think about the struggles that product owners go through, I just have to kind of salute them and say thank you for being out there, and thank you for trying to bring great products to the world, because it is a very large role. You know, something that Todd and I talk about quite a bit, it's a very lonely role. You have the whole world of people trying to barrage you with all these different ideas, and they have all these different needs, and they have all these different wants. And it becomes this massive thing where you're trying to like filter through stakeholder feedback and see what customers are doing. And, oh, the users are not quite happy with this feature. Oh, and by the way, the dev team is writing because they don't have what they need for the next refinement session, and they don't understand the latest things in the product backlog. And it's just this, oh, and by the way, you're still an agile product manager where you have to do road mapping and budgets and just a huge body of work, and it just comes crushing in. And I think part of surviving that role, you know, whether you're the ideal product owner or not, surviving that role is having a scrum master who has partnered with you. You know, Todd and I, we like to call the scrum master and the product owner that kind of relationship. It's kind of like your ride or die, where as a scrum master, that's your person. That is your one of your best friends on the planet. You are there to serve them. You're there to help with that burden. You're there to find ways for agile product management to happen. You're there to foster the relationship between the product owner and the dev team, because a lot of that work can happen. You know, refinement isn't just a product owner thing. The dev team helps with that. And just finding ways to get better collaboration between all the different roles and stakeholders. You know, if you've got a great scrum master partnered with a great product owner, the burdens and the massiveness of this job, of this role, can be managed. And now when we don't have that, now we need a product owner, you know, like you said, Paul, who's that ideal person. And I think it's going to be different for every single product, right? It's going to be definitely context specific. But I will say this, I think when we have our product, when we're talking to product owners, we're really looking for someone who has that eye for change, who can notice when a customer is using a product in an off-brand way, but they see the potential for a new idea. And I think those kind of product owners are interesting. I think the product owners that I really love to work with as well, they're encouraging the dev team to connect with the customer. They're encouraging other points of view. They're encouraging, you know, newer insights and new sets of eyes on the way the customers and stakeholders are interacting with the product. I think it's that openness. They're leveraging that Scrum value, being open to the idea that even though they're the product owner, they don't have all the ideas about the product, right? And so there's a lot of things there, but I think this massive role is far more manageable when you have a Scrum Master who's a true partner and a collaborator, and not just an admin or someone who orders the food or someone who schedules the meetings. I think that's truly important. I will give an extra tip. So when I'm interviewing product owners, one of my favorite questions, I have a series of questions I really like. You know, I'll ask them, what is your most favorite product on the planet? And often they'll talk about an iPhone, or they'll talk about some new thing that I've never heard of. It's fun for me because I usually get to learn about the bleeding edge kind of stuff coming out. So that's pretty cool. But then the immediate follow-up question is, what are the three changes you would make to that product that you absolutely adore? And if what I have found over the years is that the true product owner-minded people, for some reason or another, they will have those three things ready immediately. They're like, oh yeah, I would move the button here. I'd put the headphone jack back on the iPhone because that was really annoying. And I would, you know, whatever it is, like they have that ready to go. And the ones who are still trying to figure out the role, who might need some coaching, who might need some help, who are still on the journey of achieving, you know, the abilities to handle this role, they're a little slower to get those out. And for some reason, this tends to work out okay. But I think it's that, you know, that person is constantly looking at the things in their life and they're thinking, how can I make that coffee maker more interesting? Or how do we make a toaster fly, or whatever it is? But it's just that curiosity. It's that openness. And I think those things really shine through.
While we're talking about the product owner role, there's something that I might have misunderstood in the book, which is why it's great that I actually get to get the author on the phone after I read it. But that is, you told a story in the book about a company that had multiple teams working on one product, and they were organized by functional area. And the team the company allowed the teams to reorganize, to self-organize into cross-functional teams. So I get that. And I've worked with a lot of companies that do have cross-functional teams that are all collaborating together on the same product. And my question is, with the product owner role being so crucial and such a huge time commitment, is it possible for a single product owner to support multiple Scrum teams working on the same product? In a company like, for example, Spotify, where you might have 50 teams working on the exact same product, can one product owner support them?
Yeah, I think it depends on the product owner. I think setting that product vision, building a product backlog, and creating transparency around the product. And this might be the sticking point. Transparency doesn't mean putting the product backlog on a wall and making it visible. Transparency means a whole team or team's understanding of the product and what we're trying to do. And when we scale up to 50 people, maybe there is, you know, a need to have some product managers supporting a product owner. You know, and I've seen those patterns at play, and I think it can work very well. I think we run the risk of getting back into this proxy product owner type of pattern that we are very clear about trying to avoid. But I think having this, a product owner who's focused on setting a proper product vision, directionally making sure that the teams understand what's needed, and having a product backlog in place that all the teams can pull from, I think that's manageable. When you get to the 50 team example, like, you know, the Spotify example that you're giving, I think then we start looking at how does a product owner delegate authority to product lines or aspects of a product. And at that point, if they're delegating to a product manager to make decisions, and we're not getting the delays in decision making, if we're not turning into proxies, if we're not losing time and treasure and headspace because we're waiting for answers, then we're probably fine, right? And so I think a lot of different models can work, but the principles we talk about in the book are important. You know, we don't want proxy product owners. We don't want teams waiting for decisions. We don't want product owners to disappear. Like, that's a huge anti-pattern we spend a lot of time on. You know, if that product owner disappears, we end up with dev teams often making decisions about products. And when we get to sprint review, that's typically, that doesn't work out very well. And so I think follow the principles. Scaling is definitely a thing. We intentionally did not go into the scaling issue in the book. And the reason for that, Todd and I sat down and talked about it, and we're like, look, most Scrum implementations in the world are struggling to get one team working well with this framework. Let's not worry about scaling until the next book. But yeah, when you get to that 50-person level, I think you have to start thinking about the delegation of authority, perhaps product managers supporting. But again, if you have a product owner with a competent, amazing, professional Scrum Master partnered with them, I think they can handle far more than what people would initially think.
So what could be the piece of advice that you would give for the newbie product owner on his first day? Imagine that there's new product owner coming into the office and there is something crucial that you would like to tell to him or her.
I think I would tell her, form an amazing relationship with the dev team. These are your collaborators. These are your partners in turning ideas into product. You need to have a strong relationship with this team because you're going to spend a lot of time collaborating with them. This is not a, you know, it's far too often in companies you see business versus IT and you see all these silos and walls up. I mean, in Scrum, we're basically saying, look, we are one company. A cross-functional team has business people and tech people and security people and legal and finance. I mean, we really mean it. All the people needed to deliver. And so when we've got this cross-functional team put together, that product owner needs to be a collaborator, a partner, you know, and have a great relationship with that group. And if that relationship is right, I think everything else falls into place.
Yeah. And you gave away also a few minutes ago what you didn't include in the book for the purpose, I mean, the scaling issues. Was there anything else that you and Todd thought like, oh, yes, that could be in the book, like any great story or some other aspects, but simply you didn't have a place for that or you thought that there would be like a third book?
You know what? We poured everything we know about helping teams into this book and we... You know, so one of our early reviewers actually sent us a kind of an angry note saying, you know, you're going to put some people out of business here. You guys are actually telling people how to solve real problems. You're not supposed to do that. And Todd and I were like, look, there's so many books that already have the basics, right? There's so many Scrum books that, you know, here's what this event is and here's the time box. And we're like, you know what, if we're not going to just pour everything into it, it's not worth doing. And so we tried to do that. I think there's one area this is a really good question because there's one area that we debated on for a while. And I think we are going to maybe in a second edition, like it's one of the, it pained us a little bit. We really, really, really wanted to talk about flow metrics and using Kanban within Scrum. And we just ran out of space. Like, and what we decided was these are advanced topics. These are things that we can probably cover somewhere else, but we really spent a lot of time going back and forth on, should we talk about cycle time, throughput, WIP limits, item aging, Kanban principles at play within Scrum? And we finally decided that would probably create an unclear message for the book because it really is a Scrum Master book. It's not a metrics book. And so I think we're going to save that but that was the one thing that we probably stressed about the most. And but otherwise, hopefully, as you read the book, I mean, we really just when Todd and I step into a client and we meet with them for the first time and we notice there's an issue with their daily Scrum. What we do on day one is in that chapter. Like mm-hmm. we tried to put it all out there. But yeah, the flow metrics and some of the Kanban ideas that we're playing with at Scrum.org, we wanted to put them in. We could not find a clean way to do it.
Yep, I can understand that. I did notice as a Kanban person myself, I noticed that all of the things that you mentioned did make it into the book. You do mention flow metrics. You do mention WIP limits. You do mention cycle time. You do mention aging. But all just in passing, just as ideas that are out there, but not going in not going into detail on them. So yeah, I think I would love to see what you have to say when you issue the next edition or the book about Kanban and Scrum, how you weave those things together, because the way that you tell the stories and the way that you offer such clear and actionable advice would be very interesting as a Kanban coach and trainer for me to hear. It would be like this version of a version of this book for me. That I'd love, if you want to write that book, I'd love to read it.
I'll talk to Todd about it. We'll see what he wants to do too.
So you had mentioned a bit about what you would do on the first day, and something that jumped out at me in that chapter, which I really enjoyed, and I want to just poke at a little bit, is the idea that one of the things that you recommend if people are struggling with Scrum is to help them understand that Scrum is actually a reasonably simple framework. It only has 11 components, and that they should get good at those components before they start adding others. And there's so many pieces that we think of as being part of Scrum that actually aren't, like burndown charts, not in Scrum, estimating, not part of the Scrum framework, story points, planning poker. These things are just add-ons that may or may not serve your purposes. And so you would recommend removing those things and just focusing on getting the core elements correct. But what jumps to my mind as I read that is, if you've got a team, for example, that is using these sorts of tools, they're using burndown charts in order to show progress, in order to do reporting and as an internal tool, and if they're doing planning poker as their way of estimating, if you remove those things, you have to replace them with something else. And would you recommend, for example, a team to retain more waterfall style, more familiar for them, perhaps, practices, like not using user stories, using use cases, or the documentation as they have been doing documentation up until now, estimations as they have been doing estimations up until now, even if those things, Gantt charts are what they've been using for reporting? Would you actually keep those things if they're useful for the team?
You know, I think initially I would keep those things. You know, there's a few questions kind of baked into there, and I'll try to hit on a few of them. You know, I think one of the more interesting things that Todd and I have seen over the years is that companies try to use waterfall to implement Agile, and they go for this big bang release of Scrum, and they're trying to do everything at once, and it leads to this mismatch of waterfall and Agile and Scrum components, and no one's quite sure what they should be doing. And so Todd and I advocate pretty heavily that just pick one aspect of the framework. You know, I actually just finished teaching a class a few days ago down in Indianapolis. And we were, you know, one of the questions I get at the end of every Scrum Master or Product Owner class is, where should a team start? And first of all, I don't know the exact right answer, but there's a few spots that I would consider heavily. You know, what if a team, after deciding to adopt Scrum, simply created a definition of done? Right? What if they simply decided, here's how we define quality, here's the organizational standards that we follow, here's what it means to be potentially releasable, and then do everything else the normal way, like however else they're working, just, you know, do that, but let's focus on done for 2, 3, maybe 4 sprints. Think about what that does for a team. It actually brings some consistency to quality, it brings transparency to the product, it helps teams understand how much work they can truly do in a sprint. It helps a product owner with their forecast. It might make estimates a little better. It brings a lot of good things, some nice benefits, without disrupting everything. And I find that that's a more palatable way for teams to adopt Scrum. I think it also shows early benefit. It gets you some momentum. And it's not as destructive or interruptive or whatever words you want to use there, it's not as jarring to teams, and they get to ease in. So during that transition time, can they still use Gantt charts? Is a use case better than a user story? Well, a use case is a valid product backlog item. If they want to use use cases, if they want to, you know, use UML diagrams along with, you know, some of these other practices, great. Get them on the product backlog. Let's start building out that practice. And then as they realize that a product backlog, maybe it's kind of cumbersome to have a Gantt chart. Maybe we could just use cycle time and some throughput metrics. And to be honest, throughput is really velocity as long as you're talking about a sprint. And so let's start shifting to that idea and just incrementally, you know, replace some of these older things with newer ideas. Maybe keep the use cases because those have worked well. Now, if a team is successfully delivering, and Paul, this is interesting where Todd and I are not dogmatic, and I hope that shined through in the book. If a team is delivering, if they are successfully delighting a customer, and if they're doing things according to the Scrum framework, but they still have some old practices kind of mixed in, that's a thumbs up from us. Like we are so excited just that teams can deliver, they can delight a customer. We're going to be pragmatic about it. And if that practice doesn't violate the rules or principles of Scrum, and if it doesn't modify the framework, hey, more the merrier. Like Scrum. There's another question kind of baked in there too, where people ask us what's next for Scrum. And it used to be, and I'm sure that the two of you have seen this kind of language, you know, it's Scrum, but we do this, or Scrum, but we do that. That language has fallen away. I think the future is Scrum and. We do Scrum and we have some practices that work for us here as a company, and we're going to keep doing those. Or Scrum and the principles of Kanban bring flow to our work, and that's really helpful. I think that's kind of a shift too that we need to make. So I'm not sure if I quite covered or answered the question. I hope I hit at least a few aspects of it.
No, absolutely. Very satisfactory answer.
So as fully satisfied with your answer, now I have one question that I would like to be also satisfied with the answer. You mentioned in the book the usage of physical boards. And I found myself in so many conversations with teams, try to encourage them and show them the value of physical boards. And also there are authors like Dominika de Granters, Klaus Leopold, Daniel Vacanti, who mentioned the power of physical boards. And still yet, I cannot win the argument about physical boards towards, let's say, Jira. How do you convince, how do you encourage team actually to start with physical boards?
You know, it's a series of discussions, and Todd and I both face this as well. We're clearly in the physical board camp. And so when we're working with teams who are really focused on Jira, we'll go ahead and put that Jira board on a projector and beam it on a wall, and start at least coaching in a way that we're moving things in real time and that we're actually getting the benefits of a physical board while still using an electronic tool. Mm-hmm. And over time, teams might, wow, it would be really great if we could have made an extra note here. And there's usually some opportunity that pops up to where it's like, you know what? What if we took 20 minutes and put this out on a board and really visualize this work, because it could be valuable. And so rather than, you know, it's funny, I turned 40 this year. And back in my 20s and early 30s, I loved to argue. And it was, I would fight the teams about this stuff. And I would try mm-hmm. to, you know, and, you know, these days I'm like, you know what, I'm just going to wait for the right opportunity. And I think Scrum Masters out there could, they might, that idea might help them, where it's, you know what, let's stop arguing about stuff. Wait for an opportune moment to propose an idea that could be beneficial to the team. You know, we need to make this case in terms of how it benefits the team, not how much I as a Scrum Master love physical boards. Mm-hmm. And so when we see an opportunity where a physical board would have helped us because of a limitation on, and I don't want to pick on Jira, I'm not an anti-tool person. Mm-hmm. Like Jira does great things for distributed teams, and I think it does a fine job at that. You know, just as I think Azure DevOps from Microsoft is fine, or whichever tools you're using, if it helps you deliver, great. For me, though, that team board, it's really the space for the dev team and the product owner to really look at the work holistically, to figure out, you know, are we actually stuck somewhere? How have we visualized this correctly? How are we showing our progress cleanly? And I think if we can find the moments to coach them and show them that how it benefits them just immensely, we don't have to argue anymore. We just get to do it. And so for the Scrum Masters out there, the team board should serve the dev team. And if we can make the argument that that board will help them more than the tool, then they'd be crazy to say no. But it can't just be, well, it's because I as a Scrum Master prefer this. So pick your spots, find the right moment, and use those moments to kind of coach and visualize work. And maybe that could help. I also think that if a product owner wants a board to visualize their portfolio or the upcoming work, it's completely within their rights to initially set up that board. And I think a product owner has the right to ask a dev team, hey, while we're doing refinement, can you help me make this visualization even cleaner so that I can better articulate products to stakeholders and to you, the dev team? And I think that's an interesting route to take as well.
I've done that before. As a Scrum Master, I've had my personal board, my visualization, that eventually evolved into the team's board as they found themselves spending more time looking over my shoulder than looking at their computer monitors.
You know, Paul, I like that a lot. I think Scrum Masters, there's nothing wrong with having an impediments backlog. Make it transparent. You know, have your own personal board where, hey, dev team, do you want to take a look at the impediments where I'm working on? Here's the organizational stuff that's coming up. And maybe if they start asking questions and they get curious, maybe then they want to do that stuff too. I think that's awesome, Paul.
Well, terrific. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for joining us. We hope that you enjoyed the podcast and the conversation as much as we did. If you have any feedback for us, please leave it in the comment at any place that you are listening to us. It will help us to make it better. If we got your attention with book, please, please buy it for yourself. I'm pretty sure that it will help you at your work.
Indeed. Very useful book. Nothing but solutions to common problems.
The next book that we are going to review and interview in March will be The Great Scrum Master by our dear friend Zuzi Sohova. So if you are interested in the book, don't forget the episode will be out 1st of March.
See you then.
See you then.